a lot of really important work. He's the guy who translated the scriptures into Latin, the standard Latin version, the Vulgate. For many, many centuries, was the standard Latin version.
He lived in the second century, third century?
No, he was really a contemporary of Augustine.
So he lived in the fourth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's it. Okay.
And Calvin does refer to him quite a bit through these sessions dealing with church government.
The other one is Gregory.
That talks about. Yeah, usually that's going to be Gregory the First, I believe. Let's say maybe 6th century.
He's the Pope?
Yeah. Yeah, he's the Pope who said any... Who said any bishop who claims universal jurisdiction is the Antichrist or forerunner of the Antichrist, which of course is exactly what later Roman bishops came to do.
And is he the Gregory of Gregorian chant, or then later Gregory?
Yeah, now that's a good question. That I don't know. That still seems kind of early for the chant, but I don't know.
Okay, so basically, where are you looking at now?
Okay, well, we were just kind of, I mean, I just kind of opened the door to discussion and anything, but we're kind of into chapter 4. The chapter of title 4 really gives away what Calvin is doing. Calvin has laid out sort of the biblical pattern for church government in the previous chapters. Now he's going to turn to church history. He says the condition of the ancient church and the kind of government in these before the papacy. You can see what he's doing, okay? If you go back behind the papacy, before the rise of, this great prominence that's attributed to the Bishop of Rome, has become known as the Pope or the Universal Father of the Church, Head of the Church, he says that's not what you have at all. The early church essentially adhered to the biblical pattern, and Calvin says this right off the bat in section 1. He says occasionally they might lack something in their way of arranging things in the church, but they tried with sincere effort to preserve God's institution and did not wander far from it. So he basically believes that the early church, if you go back to those first couple of centuries, really had it essentially right. They followed the biblical pattern, and he's going to use a lot of evidence to show this. He talks about the position of the bishop, and in section 2, he says, all those to whom the office of teaching was enjoined, they called presbyters. That's the Greek word for elder. In each city, these chose one of their number to whom they specially gave the title bishop in order that dissensions might not arise, as commonly happens, from equality of rank. Because you see what Calvin is saying. In the New Testament, bishop and presbyter are used interchangeably for bishop and elder. Calvin is saying the early church acknowledged that. He says that early on they did have to appoint some kind of moderator, some kind of president over their assembly. And they gave that man the title of bishop. So they did make a distinction between bishop and presbyters at that point. They departed from the precise biblical terminology at that point. But still, the essence of it was still there, because this position that the bishop held was not really a position in authority over the other presbyters. Rather, it was more of a functional, an official kind of thing, just for the sake of order. Because, even an assembly of equals has to have somebody moderating over it. And so Calvin says, there's not really a problem with this custom. It was pragmatic. It was practical. It was really an innocent move on their part. So the bishop was not so much higher in honor and dignity as to have lordship over his colleagues. They skip down to the next paragraph on 1069. The ancients themselves admit that this was introduced by human agreement to meet the needs of the times. Okay, so it was just a pragmatic concern. Thus, Jerome, commenting on the letter to Titus, says, bishop and presbyter are one and the same, and before, by the devil's prompting, dissensions arose in religion, and it was said among the people, I am of Paul, I am of Cephas. Churches were governed by the common council of presbyters. Afterward, to remove seeds of dissensions, all oversight was committed to one person. just as the presbyters, therefore, know that they are, according to the custom of the church, subject to him who presides, so the bishops recognize that they are superior to the presbyters, more according to the custom of the church than by the Lord's actual arrangement, and that they ought to govern the church in cooperation with them. Okay? So Calvin is going to follow here Jerome very, very closely, which is kind of ironic since, of course, Jerome was a real hero to the Roman Catholics with his Latin translation of the Bible, the Vulgate. You see again in the last paragraph of section 2, Calvin's geographical understanding of the church's structure. A certain area was assigned to each city from which its presbyters were drawn, and it was thought of as belonging to the body of that church. Each college was under one bishop for the preservation of its organization and peace. While he surpassed the others in dignity, he was subject to the assembly of his brethren. But if the field under his episcopate was too large for him to be able to fulfill everywhere all the duties of bishop, presbyters were assigned certain places in the field and carried out on his duties in lesser matters. These they called country bishops because they represented the bishop throughout the province. So basically what you have is a city representing an area. The presbyters would be drawn from that area, you know, not just the city itself, but the rural surrounding area. And if the bishop couldn't make it out, you know, to all the people, there might be smaller local congregations in this rural area, he would appoint presbyters to go out and do his work there. Eventually, this did become a big deal because then there were questions that eventually arose about what can the presbyters do versus what can the bishop do. Can the presbyters baptize and perform the Lord's Supper, that sort of thing? And eventually, some of those duties, some of those privileges would be taken away from presbyters, and so everyone would become dependent upon this bishop. And of course, that became a problem. Eli's already pointed us to section 4, you know, how this was more or less a Presbyterian structure. Calvin doesn't like the use of the term hierarchy for obvious reasons. but, you know, the structure more or less was Presbyterian. Talks about the administration or the work of the deacons in the early church. Section 5, at that time, the character of the diaconate was the same as that under the apostles. Okay, so he's saying at this time in history, the deacons did the same thing that they did when they served under the apostles, which Calvin will take all the way back to Acts chapter 6. They received the daily offerings of believers and the yearly income of the church. These they were to devote to proper uses. So here's how Calvin thinks you ought to use church money. Distribute some to feed the ministers, some to feed the poor, but according to the decision of the bishop to whom they rendered an account annually of their distribution. So the deacons would oversee the administration of the funds to the poor and the ministers. And I think Calvin would include things like missionary ministers and that kind of thing under that as well. Elsewhere, he also talks about the use of money for church property, church buildings, that sort of thing.
He talks about this fourfold division of revenue. I mean, he goes so far as to say,
yeah,
one quarter for this, one quarter for this.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, over at
section
7.
And in that, later on, one of these chapters, he says, his interpretation of this fourfold division of revenue is that half belongs to the poor.
Yeah.
Church, possession, the money, income.
Yeah, that's true. And those might have been, you know, that might have been a prudent guide in his day. I wouldn't say you can just pick that up and apply it to our situation today because our society is so different. Just to throw one example, hospitals were supported solely by church funds in those days. So that money, you know, the 50% or whatever that comes in is going to the poor, is total health care, all that kind of stuff. It's not just people who are incapacitated and can't work, but sick. I mean, all kinds of things that have to be covered by that. Whereas we have just a different, our society is just structured differently. Still, though, I think you have to appreciate Calvin's desire that the church would care for the poor. It's a very important thing.
Well, I mean, how much here is he just simply drawing from what he gleaned historically, and how much, I mean, there's not a single, well, there's one scripture proof in that section of 1 Timothy.
Which section are you looking at?
I'm looking at section 7.
Okay.
Again, this is even largely what we talked about previously. Some of this, there seems to be a pretty healthy intermingling of what he would considers scriptural proof and what he's drawing on his own personal experience or his own understanding of history. It's not clear what it was.
No, you're right. It is a real mix of, you know, of biblical principle, church custom, and his own practice.
Mm-hmm.
No question. And, you know, and Calvin did not sort all that out. Our Book of Church Order doesn't sort all that out. And, you know, it's just it's one of those things. It does make it difficult, though, because you'd like to be able to pin down what are the biblical principles here, and then where is this just human prudence or custom?
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting in section 5. He does assert that it's the bishop who had you know, final authority over how the deacons spent the money. I already talked about section 6.
He introduces this idea of the archdiocese.
Yeah.
Maybe is that just this historical understanding of the way the diaconate was divided up?
Well, it is true. These different classes of deacons eventually arose. You know, the subdeacons and the archdeacons. And for the most part, that was the same kind of thing as the distinction that arose between the bishop and the presbyter. Just a matter of just a matter of function, just a matter of pragmatism, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you have these different grades or orders of deacons. You know, and if the church got bigger, as the church had more money, more influence, and a larger role to play, you know, it, to some extent, it was necessary to take on these kind of, it was just greater specialization, really. Yeah, you know, so you've got then subdeacons to kind of assist the deacons, but then you've got to have people who can kind of oversee the diaconate as a whole. Then you have archdeacons.
But they didn't have assistant pastor, associate pastor, executive pastor.
No, they didn't do it quite that way. We're, I mean, you know, that's. But to some extent, all that kind of
operations
stuff is
pastor.
for the same reason.
Yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
the question you have to raise is,
I don't mean
do these things really help us to do with the church?
Intervention
and
library.
Yeah.
It's just a normal. Yeah, I think a lot of the
bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
It's just putting to administer.
It's just a matter of title.
Our churches have become so, I don't know, weakened, gutted, eviscerated, that it seems strange to us to think of all this organization and hierarchy, but if we were doing the same work that the church was doing at that time, it would be obvious you'd have to have structure more than just deacons and presbyters.
Yeah, you know, one thing you do see in the early liturgies, and this is something that Calvin doesn't—I don't recall Calvin bringing this out, and I've always wanted to research it further myself—but it seems as though everyone in the early church belonged to a particular order. So, you know, there was the order of there was the bishop, and then there were the presbyters. You know, there was the archdeacon, and then the deacons, and the subdeacons, and the deaconesses, and then, you know, the virgins, those women who had consecrated themselves to some kind of service in the church. You know, you read some of the early liturgies, it just goes through a long, long list of people. Okay, and sometimes this has to do with the order in which they receive the Lord's Supper or different things. I mean, it shows up at different times. But you kind of get the sense that in the early church, everyone sort of had their niche where they fit in. And so when you were baptized, when you were brought into the church, you were kind of plugged into a particular order. You know, it was sort of your office that was going to give you a role to play in the community. And there's something really good about that. You know, we tend to think of being just elders and deacons, and then everybody else is just kind of this, you know, disorganized body. But that was not the sense in the early church at all. I mean, you had your role to play. You had your order, so to speak. I mean, that's the word that's usually used.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we tend to think of church orders meaning just an office, but for them, it includes everybody.
Speaking of modern-day departure from these offices that he discusses, just for my own understanding, is George considered an elder?
No, he's not an elder.
He's just the director, not an officer of any sort.
So he could, and I would think would eventually become an elder.
But he'd be
based. Right, yeah, just like him. Calvin has some interesting things to say about preparing for office in section 9. basically compares training ministers to training army recruits, which is probably a good comparison in a lot of ways. I'm going to pick up kind of the middle towards the top of 77. It also ensured that only well-prepared persons might minister to the church, but from early youth, under sacred instruction and strict training, they took on an exemplary life of gravity and holiness, and separated from worldly cares, they became accustomed to spiritual cares and studies. But just as army recruits are instructed through sham battles for real and earnest conflict, so were their definite rudiments in which they were trained as clerics before they were promoted to the office offices of prophets. So he talks about some of these, and these would be further examples of orders, particularly for young men. First, they were entrusted with the opening and closing of the church, and were called doorkeepers. Afterward, they were called acolytes to assist the bishop in household tasks and continually to accompany him, first for honor's sake, then that no suspicion might arise. I'm not exactly sure what that's referring to. Especially in light of recent scandals. Moreover, that they might gradually become known to the people and acquire commendation for themselves, and at the same time learn to be seen by all and to speak before all, that when made presbyters, they might not be covered with shame when they came forward to teach. They were given opportunity to read from the pulpit. So being a reader, you know, and sort of following the bishop around and seeing what he does, these were steps along the way to becoming presbyters. You know, it's kind of an apprenticeship model.
Like a son of a bishop.
And Calvin says, last sentence there, he says, these were more the rudiments of recruits than functions to be considered true ministries of the church. So Calvin, you know, acknowledges that these are not official, biblically mandated orders. Again, they were just matters of doing things in decency and good order.
Would you say that this perhaps is something of a the first manifestation of the seminary? I mean,
yeah,
but today
yeah.
We have seminaries for people to go to study. You know, here they didn't have. I don't know when the first seminary schools were set up. It seems to be
that's really what Calvin's talking about here. Yeah, you'd go study an apprentice under the bishop.
Just like you do that in a lot of professions, actually. Physician work, maybe in medical school. They study under somebody and then they become not licensed. They become practice.
Yeah, I mean, really, this is how seminary training began, in a kind of an informal way through a local church. You know, as a bishop might gather several of these so-called recruits around him and be apprenticing them all at once. You know, that's the origin of the seminary right there. And the seminary didn't become a kind of a standalone academic institution until much later. That's a modern, really post-Reformation development. But, you know,
but were there not, I mean, for example, the Augustinian order
well, they were monastic orders.
Yeah. Right. I mean, and some that, well, I'm speaking more than I know here, but Luther had a chair that basically his job was to study scripture study theology and develop and teach. So, I mean.
Well, by then, that has evolved into formal.
Well,
I mean, but that was a university as well.
Yeah,
okay, so this was
involved.
So, of course, if you're going to be a bishop, very often you would spend a lot of time studying. You know, you'd ordinarily study at the university for quite some time too. So, yeah, I mean, in a sense, because the universities were Christian, you didn't need seminaries as standalone academic institutions. Calvin taught, oh God.
It's like in our country, you know, when the first people were educated here, it was basically at religious schools, it was mainly ministers that evolved the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Because that's the people that were educated. And not many other people went to school.
Yeah.
You didn't go to school to be a doctor, you didn't go to school to be a blacksmith, you didn't go to school to be a businessman, you didn't train it. So the ministry developed the educational system way back, you know, before the Reformation. It was primary thrust was probably until the Renaissance, you know, it was religion, theology, instead of God. But then with the Enlightenment, the Enlightenment came, really, you know.
So was that pretty generally universally true in Europe that the universities, like for example Harvard or Yale or Princeton, were really originally created for deliberately
train
Christian
ministers.
Purposes to train right. ministers? Would that be true pretty much of all universities in Europe also, or were there some that
I
were
not? I can't say for sure that they were limited just to the training of ministers, because you had a lot of people who studied who didn't become ministers.
You trained to be lawyers.
Lawyers or philosophers or you know, something else.
But I wonder if that was sort of a second generation evolution, where those universities are pitching into ministers and they
yeah,
sort
I don't
of
know,
began to divert
the higher. It really was the church that created the university. I mean, mm-hmm. the university is very much the creation of the church. I think the church did create the university in large part for her own purposes, you know, to train ministers. Yeah, that would be an interesting study.
Yeah, it looks kind of authentic. It's interesting.
Yeah, you know, as I think back over, the church did more or less create universities. I mean, particularly as you had, you know, bishops or various teachers who became very popular and who could gather some kind of following around them. I mean, they were sort of set up and become kind of a formal university. And people would come to study for a variety of reasons, many because they did want to enter into the ordained ministry, others because they wanted to be lawyers or philosophers. You know, those would have been the primary professions. The university did, so to some extent, take on a life of its own. In the high Middle Ages, not divorced from the church. I mean, because I think there was still always the sense of the universities there to serve the church, but to some extent, I mean, you just had a lot of people who became, you know, lifetime professors or teachers of various sorts without really doing that in the church. And so, you know, in that sense, you know, it was something different. And as Dr. Griggs was saying, you know, after the Reformation, all of that became very secularized. You know, that's when the university really gets cut free from the church.
Well, you know, a lot of governments were pretty much under the thumb of the church back then until... After, you know, even during the later Middle Ages, the church had a lot of control over a lot of the governments. You know, they had a huge state. You know, they may have a secular king, but they really, a lot of times, there was a lot of interplay. You know, there always was between the church and the state.
Yes, definitely. In fact, that's one of the things that Calvin talks about here. Calvin talks about how clergymen were elected, which he's already talked about the biblical pattern for this back in chapter 3. Of course, the end of chapter 3, he talks about how it's both the vote of the people and the approval of a body of already ordained presbyters. Okay, so it's both. There's kind of a bottom-up from the people. The people approve this candidate for the ministry. And a top-down, the presbyters approve this man. And, of course, they're not going to approve him apart from some kind of examination. Calvin says this is more or less how it was done. He talks about the balance between the people and clergy. He does talk about the involvement of political rulers in this, the emperor's consent to at least certain important church positions was needed. Calvin doesn't have a huge problem with this, although he doesn't. It's certainly not necessary. He said at the top of 1082, the custom was that the emperor would confirm the election with his approval or abrogate it by his disapproval. He says there is nothing else is said than that a king must by no means be allowed to set aside a canonical election and appoint a bishop according to his whim, and that the metropolitans must not consecrate one thus promoted by violent powers. So basically what Calvin sees in the history of this is that you know, the church and the state working together, the state having its say. Calvin would certainly rather not be that way. But he would also put up with it. It talks about ordination here. That's not real important to laying on hands. Chapter 5.
What are metropolitans?
Just city.
Okay, but it's a church office.
Okay, all right. Chapter 5, ancient form of government was completely overthrown by the tyranny of the papacy. So, remember, Calvin said the ancient form of government was basically biblical, adhered to the biblical pattern. Now Calvin's going to talk about the corruption that arose. Okay, as the papacy grows and increases in power, the ancient pattern is overthrown. Section 1, scandalous neglect of requirements for the episcopate. Now it behooves us to turn our attention to the order of church government adhered to today by the Roman See and all its satellites and the whole picture of that hierarchy, which they are always talking about. Also to compare with it our description of the first and ancient church. From such a comparison will appear the nature of that church which these men have, who are raging to oppress, or rather to destroy, by its mere title. So Calvin sees that there's a real shift that's taking place, and Calvin is going to trace out that shift and show how gradually it took place. You know, people will sometimes ask the question, well, when did the Roman Catholic Church begin? Well, there are probably two right answers to that question. You could say it was in the 11th century with the split between East and West in the Church, now the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church are distinct, institutional, or you could say even the 16th century with the Reformation. Because the Roman Catholic Church as such, the rise of the papacy and that sort of thing, the accumulation of power and prestige to Rome was a very, very gradual thing. It did not happen all at once. And it's not like there was ever any, you know, church council that you can look back to and single out and say, that's when it began. It was a very gradual thing. And as Calvin said, a very informal thing really at first. I mean, when Calvin begins to trace this out, he says, you know, at first it was just a matter of, a very pragmatic matter. The bishop from Rome, or those representing the bishop at Rome, had more prestige. You know, usually that was because of the fact that, the city of Rome itself was so prestigious because of its history and the role that it had in the Roman Empire. But it was a very gradual kind of thing. So Calvin talks about things like in section 2, the community being deprived of the right to elect its bishop. Okay, no longer would people vote, rather they would have a bishop imposed upon them from the top down. Talks about this developing. You have Leo crying out that no reason allows this, declares it a violent imposition. So Leo, who was one of the early popes, 5th century pope, opposed this. Cyprian.
When did the term pope come into play? Do you know when that evolves? They call the Archbishop of Rome or something like that?
For a while. I don't know when the term pope really comes in. I mean, pope, it's just the term father.
Yeah, that's what it means.
I don't know when the Roman bishop, when that title becomes applied just to him in a special way. I would guess that was a real gradual thing, too. Mm-hmm. Calvin might even talk about that. I just don't remember it. This neglect on the part of the church to represent the people led to the intervention of princes. You had civil interference. Calvin talks about this in section 3.
Well, the church accumulated so much power, that their interplay with the secular government just because of that, because they started jockeying back and forth in that. You see that all through.
Sometimes you have a lot of cooperation between the church and the state. A lot of other times there's a good deal of antagonism. Calvin talks about how the Council of Chalcedon on 1088 passed a decree that no one should be ordained who was not taking up specific pastoral obligations. Okay, and this is a principle that the Presbyterianism continues to uphold. You can't be ordained without a call. You can't just have someone who's ordained who's just going to float around and do what he wants. You've got to be tied to a particular congregation or at least a particular task. But what Rome began to do was ordain men without a call, without pastoral obligations. And this led to all kinds of problems because you had men who were drawing an income off of a congregation that they never ministered to.
Mm-hmm.
Led to all kinds of abuse. The beneficences, they were called. And actually, Calvin had a couple of these that his father, because this was a great way to get income. And actually, this became so corrupt in that evil period that you had to buy and sell a church office. You could buy a church office, okay, and you would never do anything for that congregation, never preach to them, never shepherd them in any way, never administer the sacraments for them, but you would collect income from that church. So, you know, the steady source of income for you with no real obligations. Or you might even hire someone out to do your obligations for you. So it's just a huge, huge mess. But all this began when congregations stopped electing their own bishops or their own presbyters. You know, that's how this began, and it grew and became more and more corrupt in the system.
Simony?
Yeah, simony, the buying of the church office. Yeah, it talks about that in chapter 6. I mean, section 6.
I thought it was interesting in section 3, he's talking about princes appointing Roman bishops and whatnot. And he points out that was no great loss to the church because, you know, the bishops themselves had stolen from the people the right to elect their spiritual leaders.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Let me ask you about this. It's 1090, about 5 lines from the bottom. These are accordingly called benefices. This is what you were talking about, right? For by this name they sufficiently declare that they regard them as nothing but the largest of princes, who thus enter court the knight's favor or reward their labors. I pass over the fact that these prizes are conferred upon barbers, cooks, muleteers, and such dregs as men. Why would you say that?
I don't know.
You never got a haircut or something?
I mean, what's the problem with barbers and cooks?
I just want to know if I read that correctly. And he really takes a shot at the blue-collar...
My guess is that, in some cases, people who did these professions just had bad reputations. I mean, that's all I could figure.
And they're probably well-educated, too.
That would be the other thing. Is that they wouldn't be able to. Of course, they're still not worthy of being called
dregs. I wouldn't call anyone the dregs. It's vanity.
He probably had something specific in mind when he wrote
it. I guess. I just think that's funny. They might be.
You know, like people that hang around a film hall now or something like that.
I mean, he like goes out of his way to say that, you know, to defend the poor when it comes to possessions of the church, and then, you know, your average, everyday, low income.
I don't know what he's getting at there. I mean, because if these people were, you know, in some way involved in the buying and selling of church office, I mean, obviously they did have some money. I don't know.
Neither here nor there. You know, this idea of the benefices, right, where people are drawing income from the congregation, essentially, is really wholesale extortion. If it's not, milking the folks for...
We have corollaries in our own society today. It's like the federal government is like the slave and local government.
It's worse when the church does it, right? You expect the church to know better.
Expect
the church to
the civil politicians.
You know, good politicians, but what do you expect from them,
right?
They don't know
take our money and not do anything for us, that's what he's doing. That list there, you can put politicians in there. A lot of the rest of this chapter is just Calvin kind of cataloging the corruptions, which is a lot of the stuff he's going to come back to and talk about in more detail later. A good summary of this is found in section 14, where he talks about the priest's moral conduct. Talking about the priest, he says, one of the things Calvin is going to say again and again is that these, you know, the Roman Pope and cardinals and so forth, that they don't have any of the qualifications of any of the biblical qualifications for holding church office. And you kind of see what he's getting at in a passage like this in section 14. He says, where do we proceed to their morals? Where will that light of the world be that Christ requires? Where that salt of the earth? Where that holiness, which is, so to speak, an abiding standard of life? Today there is no order of men more notorious in excess, effeminacy, voluptuousness, in short, in all sorts of lusts, in no order are their masters more adept or skillful in every deceit, fraud, treason, and treachery. Nowhere is there as great cunning or boldness to do harm. I say nothing about their arrogance, pride, greed, and cruelty. I say nothing about the dissolute license of their entire life. The world is so wearied with bearing these abuses that there is no danger that I should seem to exaggerate unduly. I say one thing that even they cannot deny. There is scarcely a bishop, and not one in a hundred of parish priests, who, if his conduct were to be judged according to the ancient canons, would not be subject either to excommunication or at least to deposition from office. Okay? There's Calvin's justification for the Reformation right there.
Mm-hmm.
These men cannot lawfully rule over us because they are not qualified. And it's interesting. We're going to see Calvin develop this thought as we go. In Calvin's mind, a civil ruler who doesn't meet the biblical qualifications for civil rule is still a ruler. And you've got to obey him even if he's wicked. But Calvin does not say that that's the case in the church. The man's not qualified in the church, he doesn't have authority over it. Which is interesting. I mean, that might need some qualification.
Yeah.
That's Calvin's basic view.
So where does he say that?
Well, he doesn't say that here, but I mean, he's going to develop that train of thought as we go.
1 Corinthians, though, does say that the one group of people that we should be judgmental of are those in the church, right? The ones that, because we have a responsibility to their spiritual fitness. Now, I don't know that I would stretch that to the elders to put authority, but I can certainly see the point that, the separation that he's making, that those within the church, when they are sinning, when they are doing something wrong, we do have a responsibility to, correct them, or at least point it out, confront them.
But actually, this should even more apply to the elders. Because of their office, it's very important that we pay more attention to the circumspect behavior of our elders than just our peers in the pew.
Well, maybe that's a point that Calvin will develop later on. I don't know. I think that.
Well, I think that's what he's saying here. That the standards of office are much higher than just being a member of the church.
Good point. See, when you read these sections, Calvin doesn't come from an unbiased viewpoint. He does not like the Roman Church. And, I mean, he uses this phrase, one in a hundred, to describe the remnant, right? The good portion of the Catholic bishops. And he uses it over and over and over, and never does he... Where does he get that number from, right? I mean...
I don't know.
It's not... You have to... I'm not going to argue his point, because I think that there's certainly, if you read the history of the Roman Catholic Church, there have been many, many, and even today, read the newspapers about the conduct of Roman bishops. Okay, so I'm not going to argue that point at all, but I think that, to be fair, you have to be careful. He's coming from a very biased viewpoint when he's talking about the Roman Catholic Church, and he pulls his numbers out of the air, like one in a hundred, as if he has... There's nothing to back that up. There's no statistics that say that argument is correct. It's just, it's almost hyperbole to say very, very few. That's the way I take it. I take it with a grain of salt. I'm not going to argue his points at all. But.
Yeah, well, he says here he's not exaggerating. He says they can't even deny this. I mean, I don't know. You're right. The number one in 100 is obviously not based on a scientific survey of any sort. I mean, he's just filling it out. I mean, he's saying, look, the vast majority of your bishops and priests are not worthy to hold church office, and many of them are even worthy of excommunication. Mm-hmm. Not only are they below the standards required for church office, but they're below the standards required for ordinary Christians.
He doesn't just use one in 100 here. That phrase is used throughout these, three chapters.
No, you're right. He does. He does say that. You know, first of all, even the most staunch Roman Catholic apologist is going to agree that there was horrendous corruption in the church, especially in the late medieval period. I mean, nobody questions that. So in that sense, some kind of reformation is necessary. I mean, everybody agrees on that. So my guess is that what Calvin is saying here is probably basically true.
Yeah, I won't argue on this point. I just say that this is you know, 1 in 100. Got no basis for that, particularly as
no, you're right.
To back it up with numbers, facts, or. You know,
I think what Calvin is appealing to here is what would be what he would consider public knowledge.
Yeah,
I agree. You know, like I know in the 14th century, you know, to really cut a person down, you would call that person a priest or a pope, because they were known for being such notorious, wretched people. This is also the century when you had often multiple popes competing with one another, excommunicating one another, that sort of thing. You know, oftentimes two or three or even at one point as many as seven popes claiming, you know, to be the true pope, that sort of thing. And so, you know, I mean, it's a huge mess.
The thinking is still true today. The only European country I visited was Italy, and the Italians that I spent time with, I think they were pretty unanimous. It was assumed that everyone in the government and everyone in the church, everyone in the church hierarchy were corrupt. I mean, it's just a given that it's all corrupt.
Yeah.
It wasn't really debatable.
There you go.
They just learn to maintain a society where they just, you know, everyone that leads is corrupt. We've gotten used to it.
When you look at the churches in Europe, there's no one there.
Yeah, so Eli, I would say most of the charges about the immorality of Roman church officials, generally there's no real reason to doubt those charges. This might be exaggerated, but generally the historical consensus is that on the whole, that's true. Now, we are going to come to some charges that Calvin makes that are very dubitable, to say the least, like when he talks about... he's going to talk about the Pope's secret theology, what the Popes really believe, and how really the Popes are atheists and deny any kind of, you know, future life and that kind of thing. You know, basically they're, you know, liberals centuries before liberalism really arrives. Now, you know, that's probably an exaggeration.
Well, I just want to be clear. I'm not defending the Roman Catholic Church, and I'm not arguing that the things that he brings out aren't happening. They aren't happening in huge numbers. My only point is that, you know, you always have to, you know, what do they say? Don't believe anything that, you know, you see or whatever. Yeah. Anything you read, don't have what you just, you have to be skeptical of some things that you read. And although I think that Calvin, in these sections specifically, when he's dealing with the Roman Catholic Church, you know, after all, he is helping to spearhead a movement that will take large numbers of people away from the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
It's not an unbiased viewpoint.
No, there's no question. You're right. It is biased.
I guess the point is it would be nice to have a companion document of, you know, a bibliography, you know, of footnotes and things like this.
I guess. I mean, that's not his point in writing this. I think that he's just taking a break from, you know, laying out, you know, his systematic theology to point out the heresies of the church.
Again, I would point out the fact that, on the whole, not even Roman Catholics are going to deny the corruption that existed among church officials at that time in history. Now, they would not describe it as Calvin describes it here. I mean, they would not say, you know, this is the most effeminate group of men in the world.
Like, yeah. That was funny.
Yeah.
But you know, look around today, man. Read the newspapers.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way that Calvin actually words his description and that sort of thing, I mean, you're right, the bias shines through. But, you know, there's no question that the moral conduct of priests was very low, you know, for a lot of this period. Calvin goes on. He talks about the deacons, their corruptions. He talks about the distribution of church income, how church funds are being misallocated, misspent, being used dishonestly. What Calvin is going to get into then in chapter 6 is precisely how the Roman pontiff, it's going to continue on in chapter 7, how the Roman pontiff did gradually accumulate great power. So chapter 6 and 7 are going to be real historical. And so I'll kind of walk you through that next week. And actually, maybe we need to get a little further than that. We'll see. A lot of this stuff is really, really good. It had been years since I had read this section. As I was reading back through, I've told you guys to at most just kind of skim these chapters to really jump ahead to chapter 12 and start to read here again. If you have time, read these chapters. Either now or maybe especially later. When you have more time to give to them, because they really are good. I mean, if you don't already have a great deal of respect for Calvin as a church historian, as a logician who can make a very sound case, I mean, you really see his lawyer training coming through. In these next few chapters, Calvin just does a remarkable job dissecting the Roman claims about the Pope. And refuting them, and really, if you're ever tempted to go in a Roman direction or know anyone who is, I mean, just reading these chapters, I mean, the arguments Calvin gives in these next few chapters are still as good as anything that's ever been written. I think against the Roman understanding of the papacy, it's really, really good. I mean, Calvin's arguments dealing with the claims from Peter. And all that kind of stuff. It's really, really remarkable how he makes his case. Okay, so we will press on next week. Let me close with a word of prayer. Father, we do pray that you would help us understand how your church ought to be ordered and structured. And Father, may this be a blessing to us. Father, help us now as we go forward. Help us to serve you in the calling that you've given to us to glorify you in our labors. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.